Welcome to China Manufacturing Decoded from Sofeast, the podcast where we take you through some of the major topics facing importers and manufacturers in China today. Hi, Adrian from Sofeast here, and in today's podcast, Renaud and I will be discussing how importers and manufacturers can prepare for a post-COVID world. We'll be going through a few topics, such as what you might be thinking of preparing now while you're going through an enforced lockdown, what some changes to the industry are in terms of being more remote, what are the trends, such as industries who are actually coming out of this period as winners, and looking at changes to safety on the factory floor, does this affect productivity? There's a lot more besides too, so to hear the whole podcast, let's jump into it. Hi, Renaud.
Hey. Hi, Adrian.
In today's podcast, I wanted to catch up with you to talk about what manufacturers can do in a post-COVID world and the sort of things that they might be planning or thinking about right now as governments around the world are starting to loosen lockdowns. Perhaps some manufacturing cannot go ahead, but there are some things that importers and manufacturers can do that are going to be helpful. So I'd really like to get your viewpoint on that. Actually, I was reading an article from Industry Week, and it was about the new normal after COVID-19. Some of the points I think are really worth discussing. So I just wanted to pick your brain on some of those, if that's okay.
Yeah, let's go ahead. Sounds great.
Okay, so one of the first points was that the COVID-19 pandemic has already accelerated some consumer trends like online learning, working from home, which I think most people are now getting to grips with, video communication and other quite home-based and internet-based activities like this. Some people are calling it the shut-in economy. But how does this square with manufacturing, where of course some things have to be made in a factory? Can you see any kind of manufacturing from home or activities that manufacturers and importers can be doing remotely without having to be on the ground in Asia?
Right. Well, I'm not going to cover 3D printing and artisanal manufacturing because there's a little bit of this, but it's very, very marginal. You know, the person who has a 3D printer or a little workshop in the basement to to make some wooden objects and things like that. That's great, but I don't think there's really any change there. If they had it, it's because they are tinkerers and they like to do certain things that way. It's not really for the manufacturing output, right? Yeah. The one big thing that we see is that people have a lot more time to think. You know, when you don't have to get your coffee quick and jump in the car and go to work and go to this meeting and that meeting and have all these people push their demands on you and so on. You're from home. There might be fewer urgent things because everybody knows it's a very special situation. A lot of people have found that they have more reflection time, more downtime, let's say it this way. And that's often what leads to creative insights. And we're very involved with new products, development and manufacturing. And what we see is that people come up with ideas. Well, a lot of these ideas are about how to maintain social distancing and have some kind of trigger alarm or whatever when you get too close. We get several projects like that, for example. Some others more general, like about cleanliness and things like that. But also a lot of other people are having other ideas about other kinds of products. And well, they're a little bit conflicted because on the one hand, now is the best time to really put the thoughts on paper, do a back of the envelope kind of design, maybe find a designer. A lot of designers are out of work or maybe the only half loaded or they're supposed to be working, but they have a lot of time on the side, let's say. And it's a good time to have a designer start to put sketches together and develop the industrial design, the 3D drawings and things like that over time. And then everything is basically ready for what some people call customer development, meaning talking to people who are in the target audience, getting feedback from them and so on. And this is also easier these days because, hey, a lot of people are working from home. A lot of people have extra time just because their normal routines are disrupted. And if you tell them, hey, I have some questions about this and because I want to launch a new product, they might be curious. They might say, oh, yeah, sure, we can talk like 20 minutes and I'll give you some feedback. It might be easier now than when they're in the office and everything is very strict. Everything is regimented nearly. And they know that they have these three back-to-back meetings and then they have to go to lunch to this person and then da-da-da-da-da. And then they have to hurry up to go back home to see the kids. And, you know, it's harder to extract 20 minutes in that situation out of someone's schedule. But it's a bit easier now when things are a little bit messy and they don't feel the same pressure to be very efficient with their time. It's easier to reach to decision makers and just sort of create a sense of curiosity. What are these guys developing? If you have the right message, you can talk to them and get some great feedback, right? So these two things, the creative work of, you know, putting a product design out there and then talking to a target audience, getting to know what their needs, their challenges are, and so on. That's a bit easier these days for some people. I'm aware it's not for everybody, but that's great. And then when you see that things get back to normal and you see that, well, either there's very strong demand for your product or there's strong demand and the economy is sort of recovered, is not totally crumbling, then you can go ahead and take the next steps. There are still crowdfunding projects, for example, that are working these days. I mean, it's not like the whole world is locked down. People are at home, but they're still spending money. Okay, so that's one thing we have seen, and it makes a lot of sense.
Okay, yeah, good points. I think people are probably spending more money than ever online and would certainly be interested in crowdfunding projects. Actually, we did just create a good case study about one of those, so I will share that in the show notes because that'll be of interest to hardware startups who are listening.
That's right. Yeah. And a company that's going through Indiegogo crowdfunding right now, right? That's the one you're mentioning, right? Yeah,
yes.
One of our clients.
Absolutely.
And they already, I don't know, 65-70% into their funding goal, and
that's right.
They will get there. So some people might think it's the worst time. Actually, it might not be. And they sold to gym enthusiasts, you know, just when all the gyms are closed.
Yes.
I mean, these guys are, they have courage. That's good.
The at-home fitness industry is kind of booming, though. And, you know, fitness trackers and things like that can still be used by sort of at-home gym enthusiasts. So I suppose there's always a way to twist and turn and to adapt to the changing market. But yeah, I like what you're saying about getting in touch with people, because I think it's there's very few people that don't have 20 minutes to spare at the moment if they're working from home.
That's right, yes. And yeah, as you mentioned, the gym at home, that's a big thing. I mean, some of our clients buy gym equipment from different suppliers. Usually it's in China. And, they run out of stock in the US, in the UK, in different European countries and so on. Mm. A lot of people say, well, I can't go to the gym. Okay, but I need my barbells and my weights and the rack and this and this and that. And all this inventory got sold, and the manufacturers of gym equipment are very busy these days in China. They are among the lucky few. I mean, not as lucky as those making these nitrile gloves and KN95 masks and things like that, for sure. It's not the same story, but they're pretty damn busy.
Sure.
That's for sure. They're very busy. So gym products are doing quite well. Anything that has to do with protection, cleanliness is doing very well. And I read a study of what's working very well on Amazon. I don't know, the study came out maybe 2 weeks ago, and they said also office equipment is doing well. which kind of makes sense.
Absolutely.
People say, hey, I need a second screen. I need a more comfortable chair, right? Because they're going to spend a lot of time in that environment, and they don't know. Maybe they're going to still be working at home at least 50% of the time for 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. Who knows?
Yeah.
A lot of companies are at least thinking of these kinds of arrangements. So there are a few winners and a lot of other product categories that are really struggling.
Well, that brings me on to my next point. So, I mean, to summarize, your point there is if you've now got the time to think about your industry or developing products, it's a really good time to do it while you don't have the pressures of certain other things going on.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So talking about which industries have been kind of the winners of this period, actually, my next point was to look at industries which are harder hit by the issues caused by the pandemic. And it's very common to read about disruptions of supply chains, you know, lack of parts and raw materials. In your view, having a look at China, which industries are the hardest hit there?
Wow. I guess the worst has to be apparel, footwear. I mean, if you don't even go out, well, you need to follow the latest fashion, right? And anyway, most of the stores are closed because this is definitely not, what do they call it, daily necessity or whatever, primary necessity kind of items. One of our clients in Canada, they're lucky because they have these big stores and then they sell at the same time some food and a bunch of different hard goods and a bunch of soft goods. So they can still sell some of these products because the whole stores are open. It's not like just the food area is open. But most of the other stores just sell fashion accessories, footwear, apparel, these kinds of products. And when the store is closed, you're not going to do much. I mean, it's terrible. It's not like everybody is going to buy all of their garments on Amazon. This is not happening. People like to see how it fits and what it looks like and how it feels and so on. So this is just a big part of a big market that vaporized. So the factories that saw this coming, they went into making hazmat suits and isolation gowns and things like that. But the majority of them are just really suffering now. They are, you know, at maybe some of them are at 25% production output of what they should be doing this, you know, this month, which is really, really, really bad. I'm sure a lot of them are closing. We haven't heard much about that yet, but if this situation doesn't stop, we're going to see it. I mean, for sure, we're going to see it. And then, so basically you have personal protective equipment, very high up, making a lot of money, taking advantage of this window of opportunity, you know, leading to a lot of quality disasters, by the way. Okay, that's an entire story on its own. Then you have, as I said, office equipment, gym, things like that, doing well. And then you have all the general merchandise, well, generally speaking, doing poorly. And some of it doing very poorly. So what does it mean? It means the manufacturers are hungry. And that's yet another reason to start to talk about product development. Because when a manufacturer is very hungry, well, they want to keep their engineers busy. They want to keep their sourcing people busy. They want to prepare the pipeline of the products of 2021, 2022. It's easier to get them motivated with a new product concept, right? Rather than when they are extremely busy, bursting at the seams, trying to make sure they can ship everything not too late to avoid the penalties, right? Right now, you can have factories bust ears much, much more easily, okay? It also means that it might not be a bad time to reevaluate which of your Chinese suppliers are doing a good job and which ones are not doing a good job. Those that are not doing a good job, well, maybe you can start to develop a backup supplier. Again, It's, you know, have them do the work to develop the processes to make your product and start to give them a little bit, maybe small quantity orders just to try them out. And if they do better than the bad suppliers, just switch everything. I mean, most bad suppliers are bad and they will still be bad next year. If they don't give a clear action plan, are they really going to improve? I mean, they're very keen on promising a lot of things. Oh, it's going to get better. Oh, this is because of this production manager. He was not very smart, but we fired him. We have a new one, you know. Yeah, right.
Yeah, they talk a good game in China.
Yes, exactly. So now is a good time to really look at your supplier pool and see which ones need to be off-boarded and where you need to onboard a new manufacturer.
Well, I know you've written a number of pieces of content about that topic, about finding new suppliers and having backup suppliers. So I'll also have a look for some of that and add that to the show notes too for everybody that's listening.
Cool.
Okay. So next, I read something interesting as well about how Ford, the automaker in the USA, of course, are restarting scaled down production, and it actually listed out their safety protocols. So I wanted to ask you about this with relation to what you've seen in factories in China as well, and to ask you about how these safeguards are going to affect manufacturing moving forward. So Ford say that they're requiring all employees and visitors to self-certify that they don't have symptoms. If they've been in contact with anybody that does have the virus or they have symptoms, they can't go to work. There's going to be no touch temperature scans before entering the facility. I assume that's with a temperature gun. Everybody has to wear face masks. People who are going to be closer to others will also be given face shields. And the shift times will be longer and staggered with arrivals and exits at different times with additional cleaning. So, I mean, is this already, because China's manufacturing has already been sort of increasing since their lockdown up to now. So is this what you've seen in China as well?
Some of this, yes. Mm. So in China, it took a little bit of time to plan ahead during the Chinese New Year holiday. And then, you know, they pushed back the date when manufacturing could resume. And any office could reopen, by the way. And then they gave some directives to the local governments, and every local government could adapt it a little bit. Usually they added extra requirements. So I can't speak for all of China here, but what we've seen mostly, for example, in Dongguan, where there's a massive manufacturing base and we have a facility there. What happened in Dongguan was the government requested us to have some kind of SOP that showed how we approach this, to give some training to the staff. And the content of the training or the new measures, I mean, it was very prescriptive, you know. Everybody's got to have masks, and you got to have enough masks for everybody for the next, whatever, a few weeks. Yes, temperature, definitely, every day. At least once, checking everybody. Yeah, everybody had to certify, like, this is the areas where I was. And obviously, everybody was looking for people from Hubei. And but self-certification in China is not taken very seriously. So it's not illegal in China to get the person's mobile phone number and to check directly with China Mobile or China Unicom to know where they've been in the past few weeks. Okay, I mean, try to do that somewhere in Europe or...
they'd love it.
Yeah, exactly, yes. You, as an employer, you're going to have a problem. But in China, it's not illegal. And then, actually, you've been to Hubei and you haven't told us. Well, you're fired, right? Because you signed this, we have the record and everything. You're fired. So this did happen. What else? Things like work with all the windows open, don't go with many people at the same time in the lift, you know, and actually at the beginning it was don't use the lift at all. And things like that. Yes, right. And a lot of hand detergent and things like that. And also when they eat, they don't have to stagger the times of the meals, but people cannot go to the usual canteen. They have to really stand, you know, something like 6 feet apart when they're eating, right? Because that's the time when they remove the mask, and it's considered very, very risky.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these measures are still in place. I mean, this hasn't really been relaxed. They came up with this, and it was so strict, you know, by law. And if you don't do all of this nicely, we will not authorize you to reopen, right? It was really, everybody took it very seriously. And they keep going with that. And they have that app with the QR code where, you know, if it's green, it's fine. You can go around and so on. And you basically scan the QR code wherever you are. You go, you scan that place's QR code, and then they can really trace back much more easily who's been where, okay? So a lot of manufacturing facilities and other types of operations are considering, yeah, reopening in the coming days. What are they going to do? Well, things that you mentioned, like Ford, yeah, that makes sense. You know, plus basic training and things like that, and discussing with the trade unions. And it's not going to be so much about the law there. It's going to be more about what employees feel comfortable with, and the trade unions, what do they feel comfortable with, and what management thinks is enough to avoid having a lot of employees sick, because that obviously affect productivity quite a bit, right? So a lot of people are going to come with their own measures. Staggering the times of the meals makes a lot of sense. That's something that we hear about very, very often. But there's so many other things that people can do. Now, the temperature scans, that is becoming like, you know, when you go through security at the airport, and in the US, they ask you to remove your shoes, for example.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a joke. But I don't know, everybody got used to it and feels a little bit safer. Well, same thing. They point these temperature guns at you, and everybody's used to it. And okay, everybody who came in before was also scanned, so I feel better. Well, with this virus, I'm not sure it's really that effective, because even if you have if you have symptoms, you can get some medicine to get the fever down, right?
Yes.
So it's not very serious. But anyway, one big thing is the mask. In the West, now people are coming to their senses little by little. It doesn't have to be a high-end N95 or N99 respirator. I mean, as long as everybody wears something that acts as a barrier, number one, to make sure they don't touch their faces too much, and number two, when they cough or they shout, or you know, that they don't basically spit out pathogens around, right? So if everybody has some kind of mask, even if it's just in a very common fabric, it does help a lot at the entire community level. And I think people are starting to realize that. It has taken a long time in some countries.
I don't know why. I mean, I'm over here in Europe, in the UK, and I think the mask thing is very slow to get going here. Kind of get the feeling like the government here don't want to advise or mandate people to wear masks, because they know that there isn't a supply to provide people with, because they don't even have enough for healthcare providers, probably. So, I mean, I think it's an issue, but it is a concern when, you know, people are working in shops even now and supermarkets, and they're not wearing masks, and then they're in contact with a lot of people. You know, is it a good idea? We shall see, I suppose. For in terms of manufacturing, though, because you've spoken about the ways that manufacturers in China have been dealing with this. Do you see it actually affecting things like productivity in the future for manufacturers? I mean, is manufacturing on, say, the factory floor, is that now probably going to change, at least in the sort of medium term, completely to what it used to be?
I think it's really too early to answer this. It's a tough one. I mean, can you reconfigure for example, an assembly line, you know, to just to make sure there's more space between people. You don't have two of them directly facing each other. Yes. When there's less work, it's much easier. But when there's the same amount of work and there's no, maybe no extra space, no extra equipment, it becomes very difficult. And so what might change is that people in the factories and also in the food preparation facilities and all these, you know, services that are not very different from manufacturing, I'd say, people are going to be more used to wearing some kind of personal protective equipment. Yes. Is it going to impact productivity? I don't think so. The worst thing is to have people without protective equipment right now and put them in the same old process layout that they've been working in and that they're afraid. You know, I mean, they will be slower, they'll be more distracted, right? And they will be more absent, obviously. So the worst thing would be that. So at least give them some PPE. And I would say, no, once they get used to it, it should not have a real impact. That's what I think.
Okay, good to know. The next point was regarding the revival of automated domestic manufacturing. So we're transferring focus back to the West a little bit, and it talks about Western countries who have been offshoring supplies for basic needs are now seeing issues because, of course, the supply chains are stretched, there are delays, there are issues, and they can't produce this stuff back at home. So with that in mind, the article says many of the processes can be easily reshored and deployed domestically, especially because of advances in automation and robotics. Is it really realistic to expect manufacturing to come back to the West, even if it is automated? Do you think it's as easy as they seem to be suggesting it could be?
Possible, yes. Easy for certain kinds of products, yes. But that... not for, you know, 75% of the products that are outsourced or anything like that, anything close to that. And there's several reasons for it. Number one, automating a process usually takes a certain level of investment, financial investment. It's a capital expenditure, right? So a lot of companies these days don't have that much cash on hand, and there's so much uncertainty, they don't want to invest anything. That's one problem. Okay, now you can go to semi-automation, do a lot of things that don't cost a lot of money, grow the skills of the people, especially the technicians who do the setup, technicians who do the maintenance over time. And then at one point in the future, you can become more productive, labor, you know, have a higher labor productivity by jumping into a more high-tech solution based on what you already have. That's something that makes sense. It's usually better to go step by step rather than jump all the way to a high-tech solution. Okay, so first thing is cash. Second thing is the flexibility of the processes. I mean, a lot of the production that runs into the hundreds of thousands of pieces or millions of pieces a year for relatively simple products, simple processes, a lot of that is already made in automated manufacturing plants somewhere in Europe, somewhere in North America. There's already a lot of that. And the same companies might buy some of the same products from China, but maybe for smaller series where it makes less sense to invest in expensive tooling, invest in maybe a custom-made equipment and so on, right? So is this going to go back? Well, very hard. I mean, it's in China because labor is not so expensive and they can make some simple tooling there for really cheap and really fast. And where are you going to put that? Yeah, you could bring it back a little bit closer, you know, from far offshoring to near offshoring or near sourcing. So, for example, for North America, typically it's Mexico. For Europe, there's a lot of options. Maybe Romania, Poland, Portugal. different countries like that with lower cost of labor, and they're just a truck ride away, which provides some other benefits. But I don't see a lot of that moving. As usual, you know, the authors of these articles say, oh, there's been a lot of advances in robotics and so on and so forth. Well, great, but give me 10 examples, you know. And then, you know, 10 examples that cover different product categories that each one represents tens of billions of dollars of production in China that's exported, you know, then we can talk. But when they say, oh, yeah, look at this and look at this and look at that, you know, the field has advanced so much. Yeah, great. Okay, but we still see a lot of failures, you know, automation failures, where a factory says, oh, yeah, okay, this equipment manufacturer has some great stuff on their catalog, and they say they can adapt it a little bit to make this product. Great, and we pay them, and then we can never keep it running for more than 2 weeks at a time, and we can never really maintain it, and we always have some problems, and it creates some quality issues when it's going down or like for 2 hours before it goes down, and it's just too damn expensive. And also our minimum order quantity is much higher when we use it, and da-da-da-da-da. So we just put it aside in that corner, and dang it, we don't want to think about it because we wasted millions of RMB maybe, right? There's a lot of projects like this. So people, I mean, it's always the same. People need to really understand their process, and they need to stop maybe low tech and over time go more high tech. You know, maybe go for automatic unloading and have the core of the process transformation it be automated and so on. And then over time, you go for more automation, maybe the loading, you know, the grasping the part and loading it the right way and so on. This is where it's much more challenging technically. And try to jump all the way to a fully automated piece of equipment or an entire line, well, good luck with that. If you don't already understand the process, you're going to run into all kinds of problems. So I always take these kinds of predictions with, oh, yeah, okay, show me.
Pinch of salt.
Yes.
Okay. Sure. You did mention some of the benefits of China, even now, compared to trying to perhaps bring things back to the West. There's been a lot of talk of decoupling or divorcing from Chinese supply chains recently. I think perhaps a lot of the noise is coming out of the USA in particular. This actually occurs, I suppose China might be quite a loser because a lot of supply chains, of course, end in China. But how likely do you think it is that in a post-coronavirus world, there will be a quite tangible reduced reliance on Chinese suppliers?
Well, it depends on what resources are put in place. I mean, Japan has been doing something that a lot of countries have been looking at recently. They devoted a budget for next year for helping Japanese-owned groups relocate production out of China. Not back to Japan, out of China. Okay, if it goes to Thailand, if it goes to whatever, Russia, it doesn't matter. They will get some kind of subsidy to help them move that production. Now that's interesting. A lot of people in the US are looking into this because, yes, they want to decouple, which sort of makes sense when you look at China as a systemic competitor, as more and more Americans do. Now, the thing is, if you slap tariffs, and let's say it's 5% tariff, it doesn't make a big difference because, okay, some people went to Vietnam and now Vietnam is super busy, can't take much more manufacturing anymore. It will take time before they really increase the capacity. A lot of suppliers accepted to pay 5%. So actually the importer only eats 5% of the rice, and it's not enough to completely to push a lot of people to relocate the supply chains. It's just very hard for a lot of them. So tariffs are not enough. What are they going to do? They're going to put tariffs and pay companies to relocate? Well, that might have a bigger impact, yes. The problem is that it's not that people want to stay in China. A lot of American companies are really scared of being so reliant on Chinese companies and China in general. There's nowhere around that. The problem is, where else? I mean, because Vietnam is extremely busy. Thailand, Malaysia, Taiwan, some countries like this have some interesting manufacturing capabilities, but it's extremely different from China. So people are just so used to the Chinese model, it's very hard for them to go somewhere else. Imagine, for example, if you buy, I don't know, toasters for, breakfast. You buy toasters and you go to Ningbo and you can find probably 10 or 20 factories that have a huge showroom full of different toaster models. And you say, I like this one, this one, this one, this one. Put my brand on it, make it in that color. Okay, yes, sir. Very simple. Okay, for the buyer. You can't do any of that anywhere else in Asia. I mean, maybe a little bit in Korea or Taiwan to a very limited extent. Mm. But I don't think you can do that in India or in Thailand or in Vietnam. It's a different thing. So if you want to go to these countries, you set up your own production facility, or you work with a large contract manufacturer that will operate the production there. You know, typically Taiwanese or Korean companies do that kind of work for some big buyers. But what I just said is for huge buyers. Now, the mid-sized buyers are in a difficult situation. It's very hard for them. Another key idea here is electronic products. Where are you going to find all the pool of available components plus all the processes such as the surface finishing and so on that you can find in China? So if you want to make consumer electronics but also a B2B electronic product, it's kind of hard to do it without China. You will sacrifice some dimensions in your project. It might take twice as long. Because in China, you can get so much done in Shenzhen or Dongguan with all the components around, and you can get the parts really quick, make some prototypes, you can test them, you have all sorts of testing labs there, all sorts of compliance labs also. You know, things are really fast, and when you have everything together at the same place, you can have the different parties really discuss and give feedback really fast to iterate. Okay, that's the model that a lot of foreign companies get used to, but can you transplant that to Mexico? Can you transplant that to Turkey? I don't think so. So you're still going to be buying a lot of these components from China, and you're going to ship them, and the custom components might have some quality issues. When are you going to find out about them? Mm. And how expensive is that going to be? Right. So that's a big problem.
So in the short to medium term, China remains a necessity for most companies. I mean, can a company set itself back by working in a different country where they simply don't have the speed, the infrastructure, the component suppliers, and all of the rest of it that China has, and accept what I suppose in many ways would be an inferior service in terms of speed and delivery?
Yeah, I might not agree with the end of your sentence. So if you can find a good manufacturer in Romania or in Mexico, and there are some of them, okay, in your product category, that's the hardest part, okay, who are already sort of trained on your product and don't need to learn everything from A to Z. You don't need to transfer all the technology and everything. They already get some of that. If you can find these companies, it might benefit your business quite a bit, because the lead times would be shorter. They can accept smaller batches and so on. But this requires that you can source the components in the same area. So a lot of people are talking about the regionalization of the supply chains. That's a very interesting concept. So North America will try more and more to source from Mexico and Central America and locally. Europe, you know, will look at Eastern Europe and Northern Africa, and Turkey. Okay, that does make sense. But if you look at the products that are made in plastic, in metal, silicon, and so on, no problem. But when you go into products that have long bills of material that include, for example, electronic components or some really specialty custom-made parts and things like that, it becomes more and more difficult. And China has crushed their competitors so much over the past 20 years, sometimes you really cannot find an alternative source because they've all been wiped out. I mean, try to find a factory that makes plush toys in Europe, you know. All of this went to China, and then now it's going around in Vietnam and a few other Asian countries. But it's gone. If you want to train people to make plush toys again, you can, but you're going to have to be patient a little bit at the beginning, right? It's not that difficult. It's striking because it's a relatively simple product, but it's actually not easy to go to a manufacturer of plush toys, you know, that has a showroom to show you different kinds of plush toys and that will get what you say right away. And yes, okay, this is the kind of stitching to do this. Oh, the stuffing we can do like this. And oh yeah, of course, this is the way we control that the eyes are, you know, they don't look weird and things like that. No, because they're not used to that. So you will have to work with companies that make, you know, some kind of garments, some other soft goods, to see how they can, how good they can do the job, right? So it's a little bit of a rocky transition, but once it gets going, I mean, it might be just a few hours by truck away from your key market, and then you don't have to have so much working capital, and you don't have to deal with Chinese business people, which, let's be very clear, not many purchasers in the West are very happy about, right? So people need to really put some efforts into it. That's my meaning. And if they just think that they just need to find the supplier that works just like their Chinese supplier and makes the whole process just as easy as in China, most of the time it's not going to happen. Or it's going to be domestic and it's going to be a totally different price, and they're going to be shocked. And they're not going to factor in that I don't need to take a ticket and, you know, and fly 6 times a year or 12 times a year to China. I don't have to do this. I don't have to do that. I don't have to pay for transportation. I don't have to have so much working capital. I don't need to worry about so many quality issues. I don't need all that. The problem is people don't update their calculations, you know, and when they see a price of a domestic supplier that is 50% higher than a Chinese supplier, actually the total cost of ownership might be lower. And maybe the domestic supplier might really support them for making different variations of the product, you know, push some new versions faster onto the market and so on. But people usually, that's what I found, they really want to replicate the Chinese model. What worked for them in China is what they want to do, you know, just the same way. So they don't have to retrain their people. They don't have to rewrite the procedure. They don't have to change their business model. Mm. And working with China comes with a certain business model. And if you don't want to work with China, then you have to change. And it's very painful for a lot of companies. So a lot of people are underestimating that, I think. And that's actually a key criterion.
I can imagine. Yeah, that's an interesting view on how likely it is, I suppose, that companies might be decoupling from having a Chinese supply chain anytime soon. That's really good. The last point that I wanted to finish up on was more on the digitization side of things. So there's a point made in the article talking about digitization as a competitive advantage. They talk about, because of the economic and social downturn caused by COVID-19, this is likely to create a much deeper divide between manufacturers who've only just started to digitize and those who are much further ahead in that process. So can you talk to me a little bit about digitization and why manufacturers and importers might be interested in this as something that they should be focusing on in a post coronavirus world?
How to summarize this? Well, there's some obvious benefits of having some level of digitization. These days, buyers cannot fly to China, or it's very, very cumbersome. Very few of them do. So if the buyer is not coming, how do they know what's going on, right? So if a company digitized some of their operations, at least they can share some of that maybe with the buyer. Okay, and at a very very simple level, at least some of the quality control activities, right? So we have that software sync control basically digitizes the product inspections and factory audits, and then buyers can request maybe some hey, do an audit on this line, whatever, once a month, and do an inspection, like a first article inspection, and then maybe an in-process inspection, and then a final inspection on every batch, and send me the reports and show me the statistics and everything. Well, that's a plus for the buyer for sure, right? So one thing is communication of what's going on. When the buyers cannot come, they don't know, you know, if the key staff is still there, if the boss just purchased a new car, and all these things that buyers like to look at, right? So, well, apart from that, frankly speaking, I don't know, because manufacturers still have their management on site. So for the management of the factory, there's not much change. Okay, what happens is for the manufacturers in Europe, in North America, a lot of the staff is at home, and a lot of the maybe the project managers, the purchasers, and so on will still be at home even when the production operators are working at the factory. So for them, it would be a big plus to digitize.
But and it ties into the remote work that we were talking about earlier as well.
Yes, absolutely. When you have a part of your workforce that's working remotely, you want to share information much more easily and more fully. That's for sure. So I think what's going to happen is that people will gain the awareness, you know, of the benefits of digitization, and they might push their suppliers to go down that road more. But I don't think it's going to come from the local Chinese-owned manufacturers.
And I remember you actually wrote an article about digitization and the future of manufacturing on SyncControl's blog. I think that we can share that out for the listeners as well in the show notes.
Oh, yeah.
Great. Okay. Okay. Thanks, Renaud, for having a chat with me about preparing for a post-coronavirus world. Some really great points there. So thanks for your knowledge and your input.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. It was good. Good discussion.
Great. We'll catch up with you next time. For everybody listening, if you've enjoyed the podcast, please like and share. Remember to subscribe. And we'll see you soon. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks. See you next time.